This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Voters in Zimbabwe went to the polls today by foot, donkey cart, bicycle, and bus to cast their votes in a closely watched parliamentary election. President Robert Mugabe, who has ruled the country since its independence from Great Britain in 1980, promised to hold a fair election, but millions of Zimbabweans and foreign observers question that commitment to democracy. Once called the breadbasket of Africa in recent years, Zimbabwe has struggled with both political oppression and spiraling poverty and famine. It sounds like an all too familiar tale out of Africa, but is Zimbabwe's slide from hope to despair emblematic of the entire continent? Several other African countries are also approaching elections, some with more optimism than others. Looking around the continent, how is democracy faring in Africa? With 47 countries to consider, the picture is complex and fascinating. Later in the show, we look at one legacy of the Terri Schiavo case and increased public awareness about living wills. But now, democracy, Africa style. Are you from Africa, or have you lived there? We would like to hear from you. How is democracy faring in your home country? What gives you cause for hope or concern? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our first stop is Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe, to get an update on the election there. Craig Timberg, the South Africa Bureau Chief for the Washington Post, joins us now from his hotel. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Hello, Craig, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
We're having a little trouble hearing you. Let me ask you if you can tell us what the voter turnout was like today.
So the voter turnout was fairly heavy in urban areas, quite light in rural areas.
Mm-hmm. Any obvious support for the opposition or for the President Mugabe's party?
Well, it's very hard to tell, as one reporter around a country of 13 million people, but I generally found a lot more support for the opposition in the places I traveled in, and even among some people who had voted for the president's party, and they weren't ready to do so again this time around.
There are concerns that this election was rigged. Any evidence of that?
Well, there's plenty of evidence of things like false arrests, intimidation, and people being kind of rounded up. What's not clear and won't be clear for another few hours and maybe another few days is exactly what's happening with it. And so we're all sort of watching with breath to see if the results resemble what I think we're seeing on the ground, at least the official results.
Mm-hmm. Any indication that the opposition may gain seats in parliament even if it doesn't win?
Yeah, I just to judge that, frankly. I mean, my instincts as a reporter would suggest that the opposition very well could gain seats, but nobody in my position really knows, you know, be done with the counting once people are behind closed doors, and so it's a mystery.
If Mugabe's party wins again, do you expect protests or unrest?
Yeah, that's a tough call. I mean, Zimbabwe have not taken to the streets the way Africans did during the apartheid era. So there's not a long tradition of that sort of thing here, but at least possible. One of the most prominent critics of the regime, the archbishop down in Bulawayo, a guy named Kube, has called on people to protest when this election is over because he's so certain that it will be. Whether that happens or not is anybody's guess.
Craig, we're having trouble with the phone line. I think we're going to have to ring off, but thank you very much.
Okay.
Craig Timberg is the Washington Post South Africa Bureau Chief. He joined us by cell phone from his hotel in Harare, Zimbabwe. With a place as large and far away as Africa, there is a temptation to generalize, to hear the music of Senegal and dub it African music, to dream of a safari in Kenya, and imagine that elephants and giraffes roam the entire continent, to hear news stories about AIDS rates and flawed elections, and assume the bad news is ubiquitous. So to get the big picture, we luckily found a man who can tell us about the other 46 Countries of Africa. Joel Barkin, is a professor of political science at the University of Iowa and the author of a forthcoming book on emerging legislatures in emerging African democracies. He joins us now by phone from his home in Keystone, Colorado. Welcome to the program, Dr. Barkin.
Thank you very much, John.
You've written that there's both reason for optimism and realism in Africa. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is the following. You gave an excellent introduction there, a bit overgenerous to me, but your point about that Africa is a very diverse place. There are 47 countries. There are really many Africas, and I think we need to understand, that is, all of us, and particularly the public, that there are several Africas, and to simplify it, we can perhaps collapse the 47 countries into four categories. There are two or three countries that are approaching consolidated democracies. Botswana would be one, South Africa would be the other, Mauritius. Then there are about 15 countries which you might call aspiring democracies. These are countries that have now held three, sometimes four elections, an increasingly free press, strong civil society, increasing independence of the judiciary. There's a lot of variation in this group, but it includes places like Kenya, Tanzania, especially Ghana, Benin, etc. Then you have a more pessimistic category, authoritarian states. There are about another 17, 18, 20 of these, places like Cameroon and Chad. And then you have the handful of states that we hear about in the news all the time, the failed states, Sierra Leone, which is now trying to put back a government, Liberia, and worse, Congo, Sudan, Somalia, which now has a provisional government, but that government is not yet back in Mogadishu. So there's quite a bit of variation here, and it ranges from the very optimistic to the bottom.
Of the countries that are most democratic, like South Africa and Ghana, what's going right? Why is democracy flourishing there?
Well, what's going right in these countries is the following. The key basis of democratization is the building of democratic institutions, on the one hand, and a strong society and free press on the other. By political institutions, I mean a strong and independent legislature that can oversee the executive. You have that in South Africa. You certainly now have that in Ghana. You have it in Kenya. It's beginning to merge in a number of other places. An independent judiciary, certainly true of South Africa, Ghana, Uganda. Kenya is a bit questionable, but it's coming along. So these are key on the formal institution side. And then civil society, interest groups, which act as a counterweight to government and which articulate the aspirations of various segments of society. Where you have a strong civil society, you have a greater prospect of democracy. The problem is that tends to occur most in those countries that have the largest urban population, such as South Africa, where over 50% of the population is an urban, or Kenya, where you now have about 25%, or Ghana. So some of this is determined by demographics, and some of it is determined by the individuals involved who organize groups and have organized oppositions to authoritarian rule and have brought about this change in the last 10 years. A final point here is that the countries I mentioned are very different than they were 12 or 13 years ago. South Africa was under apartheid. Kenya was under a very authoritarian regime where people were tortured. Ghana under a military regime. So if you take the change in 10-year periods rather than, shall we say, being impatient and looking at one election, we can see that there is some cause for optimism on the continent.
Mm-hmm. I suppose you could say on the other side that the countries that aren't doing very well don't have some of the things that you just described, like a free press or civil society. What else is keeping democracy from succeeding there?
Well, it's mainly the weakness of civil society. One must remember that Africa is fundamentally an agrarian continent. There's considerable variation from one country to the next. But the landlocked states in Africa, the poor countries, are overwhelmingly rural in terms of their population. Their population consists mainly of peasant farmers, that is to say, those who are farmers who are farming for their own subsistence, selling a little bit in the market. They don't move around very much. They don't have much contact with the capital city. And conversely, civil society is very much, in Africa, a phenomenon of urban-based professionals. lawyers, activists for democratic change, and the like. And the real key to the process of democratization is whether these groups can develop what I call a rural reach and organize the rural population. Where that has happened, as in Kenya, as in Ghana, you move forward. Where they're more constrained, you don't. And, of course, these groups face authoritarian and semi-authoritarian rulers, which makes their life very difficult, as is occurring in Zimbabwe today.
Let's go quickly to one of our callers to get them in before the first break. Miriam in Berkeley, California. Miriam, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
You have a question or a comment?
I actually specifically have a comment. What I want to say is that there needs to be a focus on the part of the media in Western countries in showing the serious advocacy that happens in the different communities in the diaspora, especially in America and in Europe. Every time we get news and clips about Africa, there is an extensive research on what the problems are and less research on real solutions that are happening in the communities.
Would you agree with that, Professor Barkin?
I would, but I'm a little bit confused by the caller in terms of what community she's referring to. The African diaspora.
Let me just be a little bit more specific then.
Okay. Yeah, be a little more specific, Miriam.
Yes. I'm the founder of an organization called Women of Africa in here in Berkeley, and we have a coalition of different organizations that are, you know, Priority Africa Network, whichever, and they are here organized in the communities. When I say African immigrant communities in America, in Europe, they have extensive leadership in terms of advocacy. You can see it through the forums. There's never a highlight. I went to Stanford. There was a screening of the Sudan, the new killing fields, a BBC documentary. And they always talk about two different opposing sides. And I was asking a specific question. Did you do a research on Sudanese groups that are actually doing work in trying to build a bridge and give hope?
Miriam, we'll have the professor answer your question when we come back. We're talking about the state of democracy across the African continent. If you're from Africa or spent time there, call us. Tell us about the situation. Our number is 800-989-TALK. I'm John Itzty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Itzty in Washington. Voters went to the polls in Zimbabwe today, and there are upcoming elections in Ethiopia, Togo, and the Congo. But elections and democracy don't always go together. So today we're taking a deeper look at the development of democracy across the African continent. You're invited to join the discussion. What do you think the U.S. should or shouldn't do to help the advancement of democracy in Africa? And we especially want to hear from Africans in our audience about the situation in your home country. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Joel Barkin, professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Professor Barkin, we had a question from Miriam. She seemed to be wondering about solutions and whether people were taking account of the groups working for solutions. Is that the way you understood the question?
Yes, there are really two aspects of her question. She was focusing mainly on the African diaspora in the United States, and I think it's useful to point out that in the last U.S. Census, I believe the count was that there are over a million recent immigrants from the African continent. People often describe themselves as the new African Americans as compared to our historic, of course, African American community. Many of these people are indeed quite active in supporting change back home. It varies from one country to the next, but there are very definite connections, and they certainly follow events in their countries quite closely. The other side of her comment, I think, refers to groups within these countries that are often supported by people in the diaspora. I was talking before about civil society. In the early 90s, when the whole process of democratization and early elections in Africa got off the ground, we saw the formation of election monitoring groups, for example, to guarantee that elections are free and fair. And often these started by individuals, professionals, but very fairly isolated people who, over a series of time, built up fairly large and robust organizations, sometimes with assistance from overseas. And these groups have indeed proved very critical to the process. And in fact, one today in Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwe Election Support Network, which has put some 6,000 observers in polling places across the, Zimbabwe today, may lead to a better result than the last time in terms of a fairer election.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller, Gary in San Francisco. Hello, Gary. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
You have a question or a comment?
Maybe one of each. I have spent time and actually live in Madagascar for many years, and since the island of Mauritius was brought up as a positive example, I wonder where Madagascar would fit in. With the new president, it seems like the signs that I've seen now that Ratsiraq is out after some 30-plus years, that things are starting to improve, infrastructure is improving. So I'd be interested in that. I also spend a great deal of time in Ethiopia, and things seem to be moving ahead there somewhat. I think the support of people for the tsunami disaster is fantastic, but also places like Madagascar, for instance, fourth largest island in the world, always in the top 10 of the poorest countries in the world, get so little press and attention. I think I'll be interested to see where it comes down, and it's a fantastic place. The people are great.
Professor Barkin, what about Madagascar and then Ethiopia?
Well, Madagascar also has great tourist attractions, too, the lemurs and
very, very true.
And a number of other sites. One of the reasons I think Madagascar does not get a lot of press is the fact that it's a Francophone country. And that is generally true across the continent. That is to say, the Francophone countries, unless there's war, as is the case currently in the Ivory Coast, do not really get a lot of press, certainly here in the United States. But the call
because is just simply because they're French-speaking and the French-speaking press is not read here?
The French speaking press is obviously not read here, but also in terms of where our press sends their reporters.
Mm-hmm.
Our press has very few reporters in Africa now. I believe CNN has two people covering the entire continent, for example, and the Washington Post, New York Times, the same. So they go to the Anglophone countries primarily and, shall we say, the anchor states, Kenya, South Africa, Nigeria, the larger countries, or the countries where there are real problems such as Sudan and the Madagascars of this world and the promising things that are happening there, which the caller correctly noted. Madagascar has had a alternation of government, and that was after a protracted standoff, by the way, but nonetheless it occurred, and the rules of the game prevailed, and that's a step forward towards democratization.
What about Ethiopia?
Well, Ethiopia, I would take issue with the caller. Yes, Ethiopia has had elections. In fact, I think a general point to be made here is that of the 47 African countries, all but four have now held in elections. And you cannot have a democracy, of course, without elections, but elections alone do not a democracy make. And I think one of the mistakes we make, both analysts and the press, is that we are over-fixated on elections. And what needs to accompany elections, as I indicated before, are the building of institutions. Ethiopia has indeed held elections. But for all practical purposes, Ethiopia is a one-party state. There are various so-called independent parties, which are largely creations of the ruling party, the EPDRF, and the main opposition party, the Oromo Liberation Front, has not been able to participate in elections so far in Ethiopia that have been held since 1991.
What about the relationship between the economy and democracy? Does a growing economy foster democracy? Does democracy foster a growing economy? Can you have a democracy flourish in a very poor country?
You know, this has been the subject of research by political scientists for almost 50 years, beginning with some classic work by Seymour Martin Lipset back in the 1960s. Generally speaking, the higher the per capita level of income in the country, the more likely that democracy will be, the country will be a democracy. But what we've seen in the so-called third wave of democratization over the last 20 years is that most of the 80-odd countries that have held elections, and some of which have moved towards democratic governance in that time, a large proportion of them, particularly in Africa, are very poor countries. And then, of course, we have the case of India. So that countries may move towards democratization that are poor, and the real question is, can they sustain the process? There's some excellent work by Adam Jaworski at New York University, which suggests that the sustainability of democracy rather than the transition to democracy is indeed very dependent on the overall level of economic development. So Africa has a difficult climb here.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller, Jala in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Hello, Jala. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Professor, for having such an interest about Africa.
Hello? Hello. We're still here.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
yeah.
We're still here.
Yes, my comment is that I think just the point that you made a while ago about the economy, about people being poor, but Africa has a lot of potential. They have natural resources, but maybe these things are not being used properly. And also, I think you will agree with me that there are several forces that may make democracy not to work, like you see what is happening in the Middle East. Africa does not have such an obstacle like religion and other activities. So if the U.S. and the West could help to just increase, like, whatever investment and help these democratic institutions that you find in Africa. I'm from Liberia, and you know the situation, what is going on in Liberia. So maybe if you could be an influence behind these forces, it would make a lot of difference to sustain and even to build up a more democracy.
Thanks for your question and comment, Jala. Professor Barkin?
Well, let me return to a previous point that I alluded to, and that is the process of democratization takes time. And the process in Africa under the so-called third wave of democratization has really been underway only about 15 years. We should compare that, for example, to the process in this country, which has been going on now for two centuries, and that only 40 years ago, many of our own population were denied the right to vote. We had Boss rule in Chicago that put the 1960 election in question, and so forth. So it's a long process. It is linked to economic development, which is also a long process in itself. But there's a chicken and egg situation here, and that is where there is effective governance and where there is also a democratic opening, you also get greater opportunities for investment. That is, investors do not want to invest in authoritarian regimes that are unstable. And a big break on development in Africa is that investment either doesn't flow to many countries or flows only to a few sectors, such as the oil sector or extractive industries. So getting the governance formula right is really key to attracting investment, and also for local investors to invest in their own economy. Final point here, just to illustrate that, is if you look at a country like Tanzania, for example, which was in abysmal economic shape about 15 years ago, it crawled up to about 4% annual rate of growth in the 90s. Now it's at 6%. Investment is beginning to flow in from outside. Local investors are beginning to put their money into local projects. You see that in Ghana and other cases as well. So there is a chicken and egg relationship here between economic development, democratization, and effective governance.
We want to bring another guest in on the conversation, Anthony Okanma, the executive director of the Foundation for Democracy in Africa. He joins us now by phone from his office in Miami. Welcome, Mr. Okanma.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Is there widespread support for democracy among Africans?
Oh, yeah. From my experience with a lot of majority of the Africans that I come in contact with, for the first time they are having a voice in participating in their government, which is very healthy. Each time we travel, I go and ask some people working in restaurants or gardeners or taxi drivers, they all say, yeah, democracy is very healthy. For the first time in their country, the press could publish, people can speak their mind without any fear. They all have hope that it takes time. Democracy have to evolve for a long time, and it takes time to grow a chicken, you know. So that's most of them use that type of analogy, that it takes time to grow a baby. So the democracy is like a baby. You have to grow it. Yeah. What you put into it is what you're going to get, especially the fact that it's their own democracy. It's their own cultural-based democracy. You know, all what they are looking for West to do is to borrow some of their experiences to be used to build theirs. But the fact is that they are building their own democracy.
How do Africans decide whether democracy is working for them in their country? I mean, what are the things that tell them that it's working?
That is the, you know, the tough part, because a lot of them are looking for the dividend to pay off overnight. That is where the leadership, the new group of leaders whom we think are the young people who are not contaminated by any political patronage, are the ones that are now going and talking to community-based organizations, telling them that, you know, they need to look at the gains, as to look at the children going to school, for example. Again, most of those countries that have decentralized their government, whereby the go to the rural part of the country. Madagascar is a good example. Again, they have to put their hand on the gain. The gain being that their standard of living is going up. That is not widespread.
Okay.
It is not widespread in Africa, but some countries are looking at, they are gaining that, having the benefit now.
Mm-hmm. Hold on just a moment, please.
Example.
We have to make a quick break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mr. Okonmo, let's go also to one of our callers now and see, get them in on the conversation. Oliver is in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hello, Oliver. Welcome to the program.
How are you, sir?
Very well. Very well.
My name is Oliver Osuji. I'm calling from Ann Arbor.
Okay.
Are you from Africa?
Yes, I'm from Imo State in Nigeria.
In Nigeria. The same place,
sir,
as Mr. Okonma.
Yes.
How are you, sir?
Fine, sir. You?
I'm okay, sir. So I think my question is, what could America do to help eradicate corruption in Nigeria?
Yeah.
I mean, can they at least stop giving visas to people that they know that are corrupt, investing their money, investing the government money they stole in American banks?
You're saying that if they get a visa, they can take the money out of the country and put it in a foreign bank?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's on American government on Nigerian government to supply the names of the corrupt officials so that they will not be able to get a visa to come here to put the money they stole from the government. So what do you think about that?
Is that a good idea, Mr. Okonma?
I think that's a very good idea, because we have to discourage the culture of corruption. The first thing we can do to actually put the government back into the hand of the civil society, the people that it belongs to, is to remove the culture of corruption. Corruption seems to be the order of the day. And we've been talking about coming up with a lot of anti-corruption program, a program that, like the whistleblower program, whereby people can have a private line to call an oversight group, the group that we then go ahead and dismiss that individual, that head of department, that head, you know, whoever it is, bring him to justice. Corruption is like a cancer. It has eaten throughout the culture there.
Let me ask.
So it's going to take a lot of work to remove that culture of corruption.
Let's ask Professor Barkin, how widely spread is corruption in Africa, and how big an obstacle to democracy?
Well, corruption is indeed a very great and widespread problem. Again, the level of corruption varies from country to country. And I think one must really make a distinction between two types of corruption, perhaps three. On the one hand, you have what economists call rent-seeking. a lot of African countries have had are overregulated in terms of their economy and rules for everything, for building permits, opening a restaurant, etc.
Professor Barkin, we're going to have to take a quick break, but we'd like you to stay there and come back with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation on NPR News. We're going to get to a discussion of living wills in just a moment, but first we want to finish up our discussion of democracy in Africa. And with us are Joel Barkin, a political science professor at the University of Iowa, and Anthony Okonma, executive director of the Foundation for Democracy in Africa. And Professor Barkin, I interrupted you in your discussion of how big a barrier corruption is to democracy in Africa.
Yes, thank you. Well, as I was saying, there are really two different types of corruption. Shall we say grand corruption, which really loots the government and hurts the economy, and rent-seeking. And as I was saying, when the break occurred, is rent-seeking is really the response of bureaucrats exacting bribes over regulations that are excessive. And that has been common across the continent. That doesn't really sink the economy so much as the really plundering type of corruption that's occurred in places like Congo, Kenya, and a number of other places. What one needs to keep in mind here is that grand corruption, such as by former President Mobutu of Zaire or Daniel Arap Moi in Kenya, really occurs not so much for personal enrichment in the case of Moi, but rather for money for to be then recycled as patronage and buying off opponents, financing political campaigns when faced with multi-party politics and the like. And this is exactly what's going on in Zimbabwe today. Robert Mugabe essentially reaching into the till, using those resources, not so much for personal enrichment, but to keep oneself in power. And that's why successive elections and term limits, I might add, are important. Uganda, for example, has been on a good trajectory, but is now becoming progressively corrupt, and the president there wants a third term, and that entrenches corruption.
Just a couple of seconds left here. Mr. Okonma, do you think the World Bank has made it a priority to try to rid corruption in developing countries? Are they having any progress, do you think?
I mean, their program is purely economic program. Even though they're talking about solving poverty, it is essential that they tackle the corruption, corruption part of the program very seriously. Because if you don't solve corruption, every effort, all of the governance or whatever we're doing to sustain the democracy will not work. Good governance, transparency, rule of law, all of those things have to be in place to, and then make sure that we use it to tackle the problem of corruption. Corruption is number one.
Thank you very much.
That's why nobody comes to invest in Africa when the system is corrupt.
Thank you very much. Anthony Okonma, the executive director of the Foundation for Democracy in Africa. He joined us by phone from his office in Miami. And Joel Barkin, a professor of political science at the University of Iowa, the author of a forthcoming book on emerging legislatures in emerging African democracies. He joined us by phone from his home in Keystone, Colorado. Thank you very much, Professor Barkin.
Welcome.
Thank you.